for those of you Mental Path Medicine, please check out our website. Everything I do and say gets put on there, past presentations, basically the entire process of who is talking to you tonight. So you might wonder, why do I not speak to a cardiologist about determining my cardiovascular risk? And this is one of those things where it makes me somewhat unpopular, because I would go to a cardiologist if I have documented coronary artery disease. I would talk to somebody entirely different if I wanted to prevent coronary artery disease. Okay, and I'll tell you why. Okay, and so I'm an internist. Actually, most of you probably know my history, but I'm a Florida Gator. All you UCLA fans out there, sorry. No basketball fans, unfortunately. So anyway, so Florida Gators, did medical school there, came to UC Irvine, did residencies and fellowships, assistant clinical professor for several years, moved up to the coast in 94. Basically, I've been here ever since in a whole variety of ways. Been doing truly integrative medicine on top of my internal medicine, board certified internal medicine forever ago, whenever it was. And been doing integrative medicine on the coast since 98. Okay, and integrative medicine is basically medicine. You know? So just back when Andy Weil coined the term integrative medicine, it was about, he was tired of this alternative and complementary stuff. He says, in the end, hopefully we'll just say medicine. But in the meanwhile, I guess we have to do something to clarify things. So we'll use this integrative thing, because basically I'm the biggest fan about what works. So I've done a lot of training, especially when I do my talks on oncology, you know, cancer treatment. You know, I'm the biggest fan of what works, okay, whether it's chemo or something natural, or more often together. Because so many people say, do I do Western or do I do natural? And it's like, how sad that you're asking that question. Like, you know, is there a mind-body connection? Wow. How sad that we're asking that question, really, if you think about it. Middle path medicine really is just about medicine. And when I say medicine, healing, and you can take it, holism. And again, root word of doctor is to teach. So any doctor should be a teacher. It's really what the nature of our profession is truly about. And so that's what I like to do. So we do our community health updates on a monthly basis. I try to stay topical when I can, you know, except for radiation. Ann Coulter got me on that one. I'm sorry. I just saw that video. I'm still floored by that one. Anyway, so we'll be going into cardiovascular risk. We did do a talk on cholesterol last month. So please ask questions. I don't want you to feel, gosh, I missed a cholesterol talk. I can't ask my cholesterol questions. Of course you can. This talk is way too aggressive for me to do in an hour and a half. So I really focused on cardiac calcium scoring. Let me step back a little bit further, okay? I have no financial affiliation with Spectracell, the company that does the lipid analysis. I make zero money out of it, okay? I have zero affiliation with San Luis Diagnostics. You need to know that. I make zero money out of it. So I know it's a really weird thing, because I have a supplement store, and I find people not trusting me about supplements when, like I'm the only person probably they can trust. And it's a very odd position I find myself in. So there's a lot of this kind of, who do we trust? Who's right? I'm the most science-driven guy you'll probably ever meet. Understanding that the most important things in life are the things we can't measure. Truly true. Measure the things you can. Okay, so when we talk about coronary risk, I talk about measure. Okay, I don't believe I have heart disease. Well, that's, again, it's not a belief system. You either have it or you don't. And so, well, let's do something about it. So when I talk about determining your cardiovascular risk, I went back and forth on how to do this. And I decided to do a little case presentation of some days I just saw a week or two ago. Okay, very classic thing. This is, it's not even the real initials, the age is correct. So I just went, AB, 47-year-old white male, presents with high cholesterol, and he's looking for a non-statin way to go forward. Okay, he had actually heard me do some talks on cholesterol, and his doctor was telling him to go on a statin. And he said, you know, and I don't want to be on a statin. I feel horrible when I'm on them. Okay. He is also trying to figure out the supplement thing. And once again, he came in with three or four supplements that might be useful, and three or four supplements that actively work against him in terms of coronary artery disease, trying to make his best decisions. And I'll give a very simple example, something I hadn't even planned on talking about, synthetic vitamin E. You got the Costco, you know, mega bazillion thing of something that literally sucks vitamin E out of your body, okay? And that's been shown to actually counteract and work against him in terms of cardiovascular risk. And so this one, boom, you know, chunk into the trash can. So you're not here to hurt yourself with something. And there were a few other things that were just like that. And it's taken me to a place about, wow, should we really make it, you know, supplements not over the counter? Many people think I would be so against that. I've seen so much damage by people taking the wrong supplements. And, you know, we've gone so far from thinking supplements just, oh, they just give you expensive urine, right? How many people have heard that, okay? All the way to the way now where they can do really powerfully good things, and they can do some powerfully negative things, okay? So, you know, once again, calcium supplements. Every woman's been pounded into her head, 1,000 milligrams, 1,500 milligrams of calcium. Every single trial shows about a 30% higher cardiovascular risk in women who take calcium supplements like that. Every single one. The Institute of Medicine still came out a couple of months ago. So it finally got me back to doing this again. Said, all right, there is so much miscommunication out there. Those calcium supplements are killing women, okay? But they said to keep taking them. Top three makers of calcium supplements, pharmaceutical companies, the ones that make the drugs to treat cardiovascular disease. So it was quite interesting. In that same Institute of Medicine thing, they said, don't take the vitamin D, something that's been shown to dramatically reduce your cardiovascular risk. Really quite interesting. Okay. So when we look at this, you know, who's to be trusted? It's difficult to say, and all of you have to work that out for yourselves and use your gut instincts and your intuitions and whatever else. But use data when it's there, okay? So if we take myself back to when before we started in terms of this, when we talk about cardiac calcium scores, many people have been told, I don't believe in a cardiac calcium score. Well, that's really quite interesting. And if I use the term cardiac calcium score, I've been ordering this test and been doing research on this for 25 years, and we used to call it cardiac calcium. It's coronary calcium or CAC, et cetera. So if I say cardiac calcium, please hear coronary calcium or vice versa. So I want to give this guy the best information he wants to know. By the way, he has his erectile dysfunction, and it originally started when he started taking these statin medicines, but guess what? He stopped them, and he still has erectile dysfunction. Guys out there, endothelial dysfunction, the real ED, endothelium is the lining of the arteries, okay? One of the significant cardiac risk factors, a sign that his endothelium ain't doing well, is this erectile dysfunction. So immediately already I think, wow, and I'll show you his cholesterol profile, so I already knew some of that. I say, wow, this guy is probably at risk. And so, but he wants me to not tell him not to take statins because I'm that natural doctor. Okay? He'd never recommend statins. If he did, man, I must be in bad shape. That's what everybody thinks. So he's otherwise asymptomatic except for having some erectile dysfunction. Okay? Non-smoker, normal physical exam. He's basically a good, healthy guy, me and you. Okay, so that's the person that we're going to bring in. And then I'm going to talk about, okay, the modern line. So, isn't it funny? In 1985, okay, this was the modern line. Now, you need iPhones and everything else to make this joke funny, right? But what I find is you're working, and your doctors right now are working with the equivalent of having no wire transmission on the Serengeti. In terms of determining your cardiovascular risk, we're using this cholesterol profile the same way, and you're still this staunch, and again, I can give you the reasons why, but basically resistance to anything new within medicine, okay? And most of the stuff, homocysteine, C-reactive proteins, blood sugars, cardiac calcium scores, I told you I've been doing research on it for 25 years, okay? Ain't new, okay? So most people are being evaluated with the equivalent of nothing new. And I kind of wonder why, okay? And I have some good answers for you, but what we're trying to say, what would be a good evaluation for this gentleman? And what I did is, of course, talk to him, and of course we talk about nutrition and exercise. Please refer back to my Foundations of Health on the website. Every talk I can't go into, always the importance of diet, which of course is important in this area, and I'll do a little blurb on diet. Now, you know, the importance of exercise, which of course is so important. The importance of stress and stress reduction. Two-part series coming up. What is stress? And for all of you who think you don't need that one, trust me, you do, and to define stress, okay? And then we'll look at stress reduction, okay? Way too much material to try to cover in one talk, okay? So, Now, hopefully this this comes out. This, by the way, this PowerPoint will get onto the website. We will have some audio transmission that hopefully we can link with it a little bit. But this is a slide on the lipoprotein particle analysis. So what I told him is you've had cholesterol profiles, but let's see, do you, and this is a lot to do with the talk last time, so please, if this is, you know, ask questions. Don't feel like, you know, just please raise your hand so we can ask questions. But I said, what kind is a standard cholesterol profile? And again, he's in the 300s. His LDL is 309. That's his LDL, okay? He has a family history of hyperlipidemia, and of course he does have a family history of heart disease, which, again, part of what I'm going to show you was kind of the argument against this, because any cardiologist would tell you they don't need a cardiac calcium score. They were going to treat this guy super aggressively anyways. I really couldn't argue that, but this is a guy who really doesn't want to be treated. And he understandably says, hey, do I need to be treated? Are these just numbers? Are the cholesterol just floating by? Really important things to see in this. There's a little section called dense LDL. Okay, the dense LDL is super high. Okay, in the six, and again, these are different particles, 174, 615, depends on the size of these dense LDLs. He has these small little LDL cholesterols that are getting in through the pores of the endothelium, the lining of the arteries. So he doesn't have the floaty, fluffy kind of LDL. He has the dense, not-so-good kind of LDL. So, and by the way, I actually haven't even discussed these results with him yet because these are really fresh. he's going to see him sometime this week. And so he has a high level of this thing called remnant lipoprotein. That's a problem in the body processing cholesterol. Once again, a little more than to go in today. His HDL is not too bad. He does have, again, with the LDL, you want bigger HDL, okay? So he's doing pretty good there, okay? But he has a high level of this thing called lipoprotein A. LPA is a hypercoagulability risk factor, okay? He has hypercoagulability. Sorry, everybody knows what that means. That means thicker blooded, okay? It's a genetic thing. He didn't do anything to deserve it or whatever we would call, okay? And it's one of those things, especially when we start talking about aspirin and the use or any form of anti-clotting therapy, you want to make sure you treat the people who are thicker blooded and not treat the people who aren't. Because aspirin, and again, not to rag on the Dr. Oz's or those things of the world, but telling everybody to go on aspirin is dangerous for the people who are going to die from it, and it's good for the people who are going to be saved by it. And this carp, you know, to say everybody take it, wow, you're just saying, I hope I'm the one that would have benefited. And let's determine who would benefit. Let's individualize our risk, okay? Instead of carte blanche, say, no aspirin for me, or yes, aspirin for me. So he has high homocysteine, okay? Homocysteine, very high. Optimal homocysteine is less than 8. Homocysteine is a marker of B vitamin metabolism. Okay. I really wasn't planning on talking much about it today except for looking at this analysis. But what I want you to hear is we have a gentleman. He has super high cholesterol. He has erectile dysfunction, which already is a marker to me that his endothelium, the lining of the artery, isn't working well. Okay. He has horrifically high dense LDL. Okay. He has hypercoagulability risk factors. He has high homocysteine. I'm glad that he doesn't have highly sensitive C-reactive protein, which I will talk more about later. The inflammation test is low. Good. Okay. Insulin levels, low. Good. Okay. So homocysteine, not so good. Okay. So he's going to need, I hope you hear this, pretty aggressive intervention to slow the aging of his arteries, because that's really what we're talking about. Father of Western medicine, Sir William Osler, said, a man is as old as his blood vessels. How? What a perfect, because I'm going to prove to you that saying is so true. Okay. And so I'm sorry about this transmitting up here, but basically what we see is he has horrifically high cholesterol. He has the worst kind of LDLs, the dense kinds. Okay. He has a clotting risk factor and he has high homocysteine. We're developing more and more of analysis of things. The next slide, really, this is a nice little lipoprotein particle fractionation. You have that little spectrocell analysis. It's a very, like, $60 copay. It is an important aspect if you're making decisions about yourself, about whether I should go on medicines, whether I even need to treat cholesterol. And I say that, I'm always going to recommend good, healthy lifestyle in terms of diet, exercise, stress reduction. That's never going to change if you have the world's greatest cholesterol, okay? So am I going to make these decisions on the best information, you know, or just go in any other direction? The medicines are always wrong. kind of the natural medicine. You hear a lot of that nonsense out there. Or the medicines should be put in the water, kind of the other approach. So he has a super high, comes off the scale, so he's way too high in his LDL cholesterol. His HDLs aren't too bad. They should float up through here, okay? And this is really just another way of looking at it numerically instead of graphically like in the other one, so don't worry too much about that. But this gives us, again, lions on the Serengeti, walkie-talkies, cell phones, iPhones, droids, RTD2s, whatever, okay? A more comprehensive look at what his individual risk is. And remember, 10 to 15% of cardiovascular risk is determined by cholesterol, okay? So that means 85 to 90% is something else, okay? And so we've got to be looking for something else. And I remember, you've already seen me do this. I'm not saying don't look at cholesterol metabolism. I'm saying please do, okay? But don't miss the other things. We do a vitamin D level on him, and very typically, very low. I'm not going to bore you with the whole vitamin D talk that we did. But vitamin D works so well with your immune system, working with the cells right at that level of the lining of the arteries to make sure they don't glom onto that cholesterol. Higher vitamin D levels make the macrophages, sorry, those little cells, white cells, not glom onto them so much so that you get as much atherosclerosis. So getting the vitamin D level in the 60 to 100 range, reference range in this lab, 30 to 100, 60 to 100 nanograms per mil is the optimal range. Toxicity. Potential intoxication greater than 100 on this lab. But toxicity is not seen until over 200. I just had a guy the other day, level of 252, and we had a full panel. Calcium level was fine. He's feeling great, whatever else. Vitamin D is about the safest thing you can take. The stuff you learned about A, D, E, and K are fat-soluble vitamins, and they're dangerous. Bunch of hooey, okay? Everything's dangerous in this world, but D is the safest thing you can take. If you're ever worried about getting too much D, you're misinformed. It's just that simple, okay? And a whole talk on vitamin D on the website, too, by the way. And so we get his vitamin D up is going to be one of the things we do because we know we can alter how much, okay, of that extra cholesterol and all the things are being taken up. The complexity of aging, because that's really what we're talking about right now, okay? Because everybody, we get a little gray here. I lose a little here. Joints aren't working quite as well as they used to, okay? What we're talking about is just aging, okay? But aging of the blood vessels right now, okay? And so we all know there's certain parts of us seem to age a little faster than others, right? Okay? Some people's coronary arteries are aging a little faster than others. We want to slow that down. Number one killer in our country. Everybody knows that. Men and women, etc. But it's also a marker of aging of all your blood vessels, of course. Than the ones going to your brain, okay? Really quick, funny story. My dad has coronary artery disease. He's past the phase, but he just got a carotid ultrasound from his doctor, and I got the fax results. And I just called him up over the weekend and said, Dad, you know, all the rumors that I've been spreading about blood never making it above your ears, it's not true. They're actually, the blood flow is making it there. He called me up. Thank you, son. But you want to hear this, and we can talk about carotid arteries a little bit more. He has advanced coronary artery disease, but for some reason his carotid artery's crystal clear, which is good, of course, okay. Blood flow is making it up there. And so, anyways, all right. We get it. So first thing we do, I talk to him and say, listen, dude, I'm not going to say not take statins, but let's get as much information. So if we do discuss going on a medicine, you'll have a good idea why, okay. We get an extended look at some of his cardiac risk factors. We already have a blood sugar. I'll talk about blood sugar again a little bit later on, okay? And we get a coronary calcium score. I'm going to talk kind of extensively about this, okay? But if I only had one test to do ever on anybody for some reason, it would be a coronary calcium score, and I will tell you why, okay? But this tells us, because coronary artery disease is diagnosable, by the way, okay? This whole idea about measuring a homocysteine, measuring high cholesterol, okay, it's sort of like measuring, you know, is somebody running across the freeway? Yes, that's a risk factor for being hit, but it's better to determine if you've been hit or not, okay? I like to determine, is that what's going on, okay? How fast are you running? A lot of other factors. So you can diagnose coronary artery disease. All the treadmills of the past, all those other things, useless in determining what you have in terms of coronary artery disease. This test has been validated for decades, okay? In a nutshell, to get past the political side of things, the radiologists love it, okay? The cardiologists hate it, Okay. Why? Because a cardiologist, and I was just reading a few articles, you know, in the literature, does the coronary calcium score, the coronary angiogram done by the radiologist now mean we don't need the cardiology angiograms anymore? It is a huge turf battle in this industry. Okay. And the cardiologists don't want people going down that road, just long and short of it. It's a turf war over money, as it usually is. Okay. I'll give reference all kinds of articles in the American College of Cardiology, Journal of Cardiology, Hypertension, Atherosclerosis, their literature documenting how important this test is, and every cardiologist in our area still says, I don't believe in them. It's quite interesting. Okay. And so what we do, and by the way, as you can see, you actually do get a look at other areas and Ann Coulter, like all the extra radiation. We'll talk about radiation exposure and CAT scans and things like that. This is a worthwhile test. Okay, why? Because I recommend to all men over 45, yes, all men over 45, earlier of certain things. This guy with his family history, I would have tested at probably 35. Okay. All men over 45, he's 47. All women over 55, get a baseline calcium score, see where you're at. How are our vessels aging? And we talked about it last time, but the Framingham studies, the Framingham data, everything's changing in the epidemiology of cholesterol. The cardiac risk of today ain't the same as it was 30 years ago, okay? And I'll just give you, for instance, recent trials show that the LDL cholesterol has an inverse relationship with your risk of heart disease. That's a couple of the recent trials. Sorry, what that means is lower LDL, higher risk of coronary artery disease, okay? Now, that turns the whole world on its ear now, doesn't it, okay? But the epidemiology of central obesity and things has changed over the last 30 years. The Framingham data, although of some use, is not enough. That's all I will say. Okay, and I'm not against it in any ways. And determining your cardiovascular risk lowers 10%. Intermediate risk, 10 to 20%. 10-year cardiovascular risk markers, greater than 20%. But I don't use it that much. I use actual data in that individual, not what I think, based upon their numbers, it might be. Okay, and so he has a cardiac calcium score of 54, okay? And what that basically means is it's not zero. First question I have is, your cardiac calcium zero, that's what we want, okay? This 54, remember, he's a young guy, puts him in the 80th percentile. That means he has more coronary artery disease than 80% of guys his age. Bummer, okay? That's not what we're looking for. Now, he's still a young guy, and it would be very unlikely that a calcium score of 54 is going to get him today, but that's why he's seeing me today, not waiting until he has an event. Okay, and has something occur, okay? And so, and we'll talk about what to do, but the most important thing is, wow, okay? And let's go into the cardiac calcium, and so, and again, I am not going to use the term that I'm going to use with him, but basically, left main coronary artery calcification is the worst kind. It's the old thing we used to call the widowmaker, okay? And so, he has, in the worst place, the left main breaks into the LAD in the left circumflex, and he has a little bit in the right coronary artery. This is the equivalent of three-vessel disease because the left main feeds into these two, okay? So, again, not the best pattern either, okay? So is he at risk right now? Most likely not, asymptomatic, et cetera, but he does have endothelial dysfunction. Now, a really good take-home message in the things that the cardiologist would argue. I'm not going to send him for a stress test that they infuse. Again, talking about radiology, but the nuclear medicine scans in there to see the perfusion. Because he's asymptomatic this low, it's extraordinarily unlikely that he actually has obstructive coronary artery disease at this point. Okay, because what we're measuring is plaquing. Okay, so what we've measured is plaquing. And I was going to go into diet here. sorry, far side. I should give, you know, before I say anything else, there's a lot of Farside slides here. This is back from my era. Gary Larson, yes, those are his slides. All right, due diligence. So we've looked at the cardiac calcium score. Let me skip past those and come back. Expert review on, and I'll get back to this. So what we're looking at is the heart. What we're seeing is aorta, the left ventricle, and I'm showing there's no plaquing, no bright white spots here. What you see, and it barely comes out here, and this is the left anterior descending, okay, is there's these plaque spots. Now, hopefully you can see it doesn't come out as well. Right there, and right there, okay? And what you're doing is getting an ultra-fast CAT scan of the coronary arteries. So what is a coronary calcium score? Okay, you lay there, breath hold, so you're no artifact of movement. They time the slices of the EKG to your, I'm sorry, slices of the CAT scan to your EKG, so basically photographically your heart standing still, okay, and image your coronary arteries and say, is there plaquing there? Okay, so what we're measuring is plaquing. What you need to hear about the first 50% of plaquing occurs on the outside of the arteries and the media before any obstruction ever occurs. Okay, that's why this test, because of the natural history of the inflammatory process known as coronary artery disease, occurs with plaquing prior to obstruction. Okay, by the time, and this is what you need to hear, it's just like a doctor who waits to measure the kidney function on the blood test. By the time the creatinine's abnormal, lost about 70% of your kidney function. Not a good way to do it. By the time you develop obstruction, you've probably gone through about 70% of the course of coronary artery disease. So once again, your angiogram will be a normal, and I've had this happen, unfortunately, repeatedly to my patients. And this is why I'm doing things like this. We do a scan. They say they want to see a cardiologist. They do get the nuclear stress test, exercise, perfuse the heart, and it's normal at the time. And the cardiologist says, I don't believe in those tests. You don't have anything to worry about, but take Lipitor. Multiple people die within a year of those tests. And they didn't follow up with me, followed up with the cardiologist who knew more. Okay, the cardiologist didn't know more. Okay, and they misled the person because the test, the stress test, good perfusion says, at that moment, I do not have obstructive coronary artery disease. That is a completely valid statement. If I wanted to determine if you had obstructive coronary artery disease, I don't order this test. I have them do that test or an angiogram because they're looking at different pieces of information. Does that make sense? It's really important to hear this. I have people, well, I've had a nuclear stress test or a stress echo. Great. How long ago was it? Oh, 3 years. Okay. So useless at this moment. Okay. It meant that 3 years ago, or five, or whatever, you didn't have obstruction with about an 80% certainty. Let's make that clear, too. Those tests are far from perfect. So, and then more severe, and again, you can see plaquing going all the way through the anterior descending artery now. This is what we're seeing. It's been, as you can saw, we said 80th percentile. How much your coronary arteries age has been standardized because this has been done for decades and following populations for men and for women and ages and what's normal for your age group. Okay, and yes, coronary artery disease is normal. Yes, just like arthritis, just like gray hair, just like everything else. Okay, so that's one of the scary things for people when they get a positive test. Oh my gosh, I have coronary artery disease. And yes, and you have arthritis, and yes, you have wrinkly skin. And, you know, it's all part of the same process. Okay, so it's like, yeah, wow, I should look into that. Good idea. Well, how much do you have? And so our gentleman, remember, our gentleman's in the 80th percentile with a relatively low score. 54, I think it was. Okay, so wow, this is a great time. Now, the worst thing that can happen from this test, and I've had this happen once in my career. Okay, I had a gentleman who had a positive cardiac calcium score, freaked out. Okay, started going to the hospital like every week with chest pain until finally somebody would do an angiogram proving to him that he didn't have obstruction. Okay, bad outcome. Okay, of doing a test. Sorry, it shouldn't have to be that way, but some people freak out. I understand that, okay? So, but the key is to understand that coronary artery disease, his test wasn't so far above population average. It's understandable if we think that we either don't have coronary artery disease or we do. It's this continual spectrum, okay? And I go back to decades of stuff that I know about, but basically, we know that atherosclerotic plaques happen in the teens and the 20s, and it advances over the decades, which makes coronary artery disease the most screenable disease in the world. It's something we should be able to prevent almost 100% in terms of really being able to determine who's at risk, treat more aggressively, who's not at risk, not treat so aggressively. Okay, so, and that's why this test is so important, yes?
How do you define obstruction? What percentage of an artery needs to be blocked?
Okay. Great question, first of all. So the question goes into how do you determine obstruction? And that's the biggest thing because nobody knows what the size of your native vessels are. Okay. So let's say your native left anterior descending thing is a pipe. Okay. It's like 8 millimeters, which is a pipe. It's a big artery. And they do a flow through it and it might not look so bad. You know, it's got 3 millimeters of flow. Okay. And they say, well, average is 4 millimeters. That's a little bit of obstruction. But there's a lot, okay, a lot of obstruction because we didn't know the native artery was a pipe. I'm sorry, big, okay. so I mean by pipe. Anyways, and so, and that's the thing. So a critical obstruction is usually listed as greater than 70%, okay? Okay, some people use 80, some people use 65. So as a variety of things, the same thing's going on with carotid arteries, what's critical and what's not. The key that you need to hear, remember that old adage we find about heart disease, a third of people find out because they have a heart attack. A third of people find out because they just got chest pain and angina, okay? A third of people find out because they wake up dead, okay? So basically two-thirds of the times it's not good, okay? We can't rely on those angina symptoms, squeezing pressure every time I walk a certain distance. If everybody got that, I wouldn't say you would need to screen, but it would be really helpful, okay? It really would. And so, but most of the times life doesn't work out that way. And so, when you get a test and they do show some obstruction, okay, because I have another patient who I saw 1 week ago, and the question is the cardiologist wants to do an angiogram on him, so a different patient, and he doesn't want to get an angiogram. He's kind of scared of it. We know he has very predictable angina, okay? He's no doubt this man has coronary artery disease. He doesn't even need a cardiac calcium score. The question is, should he get the angiogram or not? So taking my test one step further, okay, which is once you have an angiogram in front of you and it says I have an obstruction, this is the thing. Almost everybody wants to say, oh, doctor, please open that up for me. Put a stent in, do something, because it seems so dangerous, even though they might have had that for 10 years. Okay, and so when is an obstruction significant? When should you do medical therapy versus interventional angioplasties, stents, and or bypass surgery? Okay, because you need to hear this. There's a huge variation across this country in terms of rates of stenting, bypass surgery for the exact same amount of coronary artery disease. If Western medicine was taught so absolutely scientifically, you'd have the exact same rates in different parts of the country. Okay, so the question is, because I said I don't know your cardiologist, how aggressive they are, because if this guy is just a chance to angioplasty everything, because there's a risk with each procedure, do we do an angiogram or not? Okay, so I have to get some tests on him and things like that to determine, is an angiogram the right thing? Okay, because he has fairly predictable symptoms. And by the way, he had refused medicines. I put him on Lipitor. I put him on a beta blocker. I put him on an aspirin. I said, we need to determine whether or not an angiogram to see if there's a critical obstruction is the right step or not. Okay, and basically what I told him, if you have left main or three-vessel disease and they're critical, we might have to go down that pathway of doing a procedure. Okay. Good old, you know, Dean Ornish, the classic holistic cardiologist. So somebody comes into my emergency room having crushing chest pain in the middle of a heart attack. We don't talk yoga and broccoli. Okay. I need to get to the point where we're at the yoga and broccoli phase of your life. Okay. So this is all about. It's like, because people come to me, they're kind of, I get the yoga broccoli contingent. Okay. I'm fine with that. Okay. But I want to see, are they at that, really at the yoga broccoli phase of things? Okay. And so, so anyways, and that's where these tests are complementary, and that's where the cardiologists come in. I want you to hear that. I mean, they really do play a great role in arrhythmias and other things. But in terms of primary prevention heart disease, and you guys have heard me say it before, they supported margarine for 10 years after the evidence showing how horrible that is. They still support Diet Coke on the TV today. Dramatically increases metabolic syndrome, stroke, especially in women. By the way, the American Heart Association, Diet Coke, for women's heart disease, women are the most sensitive to the sugars, to the Diet Coke, CRP. They're the ones that get killed by that stuff, more so than the men. And that's American Heart Association, Diet Coke, Women's Health Heart Week. That's cute. It's the time, are you a doctor? No. you have those moments saying, why are my organizations out there promoting disease? Why are they promoting calcium supplements? Why are they promoting that? Because they are promoting disease, unfortunately, because that's the business we're in. So is Coke. So is Kentucky Fried Chicken and everything else. Disease makes a lot more money than wellness. Yes. Calcium supplements, which is different than cardiac calcium score. Very good. Calcium supplements dramatically increase cardiovascular risk. You would never take a calcium without balancing it with other minerals. Okay. So the calcium supplements were recommended by all the OBGYNs and everybody else like that, dramatically increased cardiovascular risk about 30%. It's about every 77 women who take calcium supplements the way their OBGYNs recommend will get a heart attack. And remember, the OBGYNs who continue to bring you Premarin and Prevarid, all those are the things that cause heart disease and everything else, which is why you don't go to an OBGYN as a primary preventive basis. You go to them for delivery of a child and for gynecological surgery and nothing else, because you have slipped yourself into this is really important for you to hear, into disintegrative medicine. You've disintegrated yourself into a uterus and a whatever else like that, and then now they're talking to you about things they know not of. Okay? And so you got to understand this. If you disintegrate yourself, do it at your own risk. Whole model of medicine. Why are we so low in ranking in terms of world health? Why do we spend so much and get so little? Because we disintegrate ourselves. Okay? Yes, and a multi-mineral should be based upon, again, the woman's issue and the man's issue. It's a bigger issue for women on average, okay, on what her needs are in terms of looking at bone density and other factors and the degree of minerals. But it goes a lot far past calcium, magnesium, and zinc, though, okay, and what the right ratios are. That's a whole talk in and of itself. So, going back. So, back to diet. I did want to spend a little time on diet because I ran across things and something like that. So diet's more appropriate than just what's he doing wrong with his elbows here, folks, okay? Even Vikings know that you don't do this, okay? So now, what is he eating? Is it the right thing or the wrong thing? Diet is one of those things that confuse people. The reason I wanted to use this to segue into this, egg consumption as part of an energy-restricted high-protein diet improves blood lipid, blood glucose profiles in individuals with type 2 diabetes. This is a study that just came, British Journal of Nutrition. Nothing esoteric, by the way, okay? Unless you consider the British Journal of Nutrition esoteric. And basically what they did is they substituted, in this case, they had people do consume 2 eggs per day versus 100 grams of lean animal protein, okay? So they had a vastly higher cholesterol intake, okay? And guess what happens? Their cholesterol profile was dramatically better, okay? Everything, we did a cholesterol talk, everything you think you know about cholesterol is wrong. Everything. Why? Because you've been sold the dream. Okay. Your body makes about 1,000 milligrams a day of cholesterol. If you eat a little bit more, it's probably better than making your body think it needs to synthesize more. Okay. Now, the idea that eggs ever cause coronary artery disease, really, you want to know how simple? Because I worked with a pathologist who did this. It's egg yolk looks a lot like atherosclerosis. I am not kidding you. Okay. So you go in there and open up someone's aorta, and you see this yellow gunk thing, and you go, wow, this stuff went right there, okay? That ain't what's happening. It's a lot more complicated than that. The sugars that you eat drive high triglycerides, which drive the rest of the cholesterol profile, which is what screws us up. That's why when everybody started eating low-fat, we completely messed an already broken down system to begin with. And that's why you see the epidemics and the epidemic of obesity, diabetes, and the change in cholesterol patterns, and the changing epidemiology of coronary artery disease today versus Framingham 70s stuff. Okay. So, again, don't worry about this all, but basically what it showed is that a lot of things didn't change, but the people on the high cholesterol things did better in terms of glycemic blood, lipid profiles, blood pressure, and apoprotein B. A whole lot of really important things by having the same diet except for 2 eggs instead of 100 grams of lean protein, which is so much better for you. Okay. So do you understand? So what do I do with this information? Is cholesterol bad or is it good? And, oh, well, you know, that's kind of what we have. We're at today. And so it does go something like that. And so I know. All right. But the thing to do, okay, listen to your body, okay? If I really understand the nature of the world today and that pretty much everything is about sales, about money, about things, and the things that you're hearing really are about trying to bring you on towards disease, it's a pretty good idea not to listen to most of those authorities. If you don't know for sure the authority, and that includes me, has your health in their best interest, okay? And so if you eat eggs and you go, gosh, I don't feel good, I wouldn't eat eggs, okay? If I eat more meat and I really feel well, good energy and things like that, even if I'm not a type O or whatever else like that, you might eat more meat. You got to be careful. Saturated fats and things, you know, most Americans eat too much meat and too much saturated fat. I mean, that is a truth, okay? However, listen to yourself, okay? The business of medicine has been promoted to make you feel like you can't treat yourself. You need a doctor to treat you, okay? It is our business right now to make you feel diseased that you need a doctor to treat you. See, since 1910 and the Rockefellers, everything that got involved in terms of the business of medicine for the last 100 years, okay, really has changed things from people being the ones who've treated themselves to now needing a doctor to treat them, okay? Sad, but true, okay? But can change that around, okay? Yes?
Two
Well, that's a simple set of questions. all right, so the first question, remember, cardiac calcium score is the best determiner, if that is a word, of whether you have coronary artery disease or not. Okay, it does not define whether you have obstructive. I promise I'm answering your answer. It does not define whether or not you have obstructions or not. If we're concerned based upon symptoms or some other factors that you might have obstructions, that's where the cardiologist and a stress echo or it's called a cardiolite stress test with some nuclear medicine, looking at the perfusions and good stuff like that, to determine if you might have critical blockages. Okay, better test for that. I've never said different. Okay. Now, like we said, that test is good with about an 80% degree of positive predictive values. I mean, it misses 20% of the significant blockages. Okay. So it's not perfect. Okay. And has a lifespan of about 1 year. Okay. In terms of its clinical utility. Okay. In terms of the, so is it useful at this point anymore? No. Okay. The stress echo, first part of the question. How, again, if you look at so many systems of healing, basically, it would take about a year to reverse 40 years of bad habits. Okay, you are changing every molecule in our body, everything that goes around. The change in those things are enormous, though, that need to be happen. They involve what you watch, see, think, smell, not just about what you eat. Okay, because the effects on cholesterol metabolism, there are so many things, including stress. Okay. So let's say 20 years ago you're, you know, eating more fats and that's why your cholesterol went up, but now it's up because you're under a lot of stress. We'll see there are different things going on. But either way, your body gets set in that pattern. Okay. It's not just homeostasis, they call it allostasis these days. The anticipation of change is what our body is looking for. So let's go into this. So if there's one slide you take home tonight, why does Dr. Forsman, Gary, whatever you want to call me, okay, think the cardiac calcium score is so important? Again, coronary calcium score, sorry. And again, this is literature Matt Budoff. He's been working at UCLA. Again, like I said, the original stuff I got through UCI, we did affiliative studies and things like that. So, like I said, the scanners we used back then were pathetic compared to today. And gave you a lot more radiation, okay? But, you know, that being stated, you know, there are a lot of benefit that we got in the 80s over using these tests, okay? So, anyways, this is a cardiac calcium score zero. This is a follow-up in people without documented any cardiovascular events or anything else and followed up basically over a 12-year period. And remember how I said if I had only one test to predict, this is not cardiovascular mortality. This is all-cause mortality, okay? All-cause. A man is as old as his blood vessels. And sorry, ladies, that saying was before the politically correct. A person is old as his blood vessels. So that's if I stick with the actual quote, that's the quote. And this goes into cardiac calcium of score of zero, and basically you can do the things, 1 to 10, 11 to 100, you can do the rest in terms of basically cumulative survival, what's happening with this asymptomatic population. And these basically were in the 40 to 55 category, 40 to 55-year-olds, excuse me. And so there is nothing that can more that's better at predicting all-cause mortality than a cardiac calcium score. And like I said, it's not just cardiovascular. And that sounds kind of morbid, okay, I know. And I was like, man, it's like, yes, I am an MD. Look, I talk about death all the time. but it's more or less looking at, wow, what things and why this test is so important in determining, wow, we really need to look at that. We really should look at this. And I think you pretty much, the more severe a problem is, okay, the more aggressive you treat it. The less severe, the less, right? So somebody's having CPR, do that. I might break a rib. Not too bad a complication. They're alive, okay? Their heart's beating. I might break a rib. Not a good move, right? Okay? So our interventions have to be appropriate for what we're doing, okay? That's why not, if you ever hear, everybody gets calcium supplements, everybody gets aspirin, everybody gets this, you know it can't be right. Okay, I tried to test my mathematical skills when I read this an article I'm not going to put you through, which is this whole logistic regression analysis, and it is amazing if you really want to take this score and take your ethnicity and take your HDL and your LDL and your CRP, you can come up with some really cool stats about what your real risks are, okay? But what does that mean, okay? It means the math was more complicated than I could do anymore. Bummer. Probably could get back to doing it. But it goes back to treating the individual. Okay, it's so difficult to determine what a cardiac calcium score means. I have people who've had a cardiac calcium score of 70 need an angioplasty. And I've had people right now with 2500s that seem to be doing fine from a cardiovascular event. And you go, wow, doesn't that mean the test sucks or something like that? No. Okay. This means that one person is tolerating their coronary artery disease better than the other person. And guess what? I see that with every other single condition I treat. Every one. Meaning, I have people who have wicked arthritis, seem to be doing great. I have some people that like this little nub on their elbow. Ah, I'm dying here, you know? Like the last three people I've seen have elbows like this, and they're fine. What's up with you, dude? And my point is that little nub of arthritis isn't, you know, we so blame the thing we find there as the cause of our symptoms. How many people I see have back surgery that is a success, but the patient is a failure? Okay, meaning it isn't just the disc that's causing that low back pain. I can give you a whole lot of reasons why we might have back pain that go beyond our discs. Everybody has a blown disc. Everybody. Okay, seriously, if you're over 50, you've got one. Okay, so wow, if everybody's got one and I find one in an MRI, does it really mean it's causing my problem? Why is he talking about this? Because not everybody who has some cardiac, you know, there's some people over here. Remember, cumulative survival at 70%. That means 70% with over 1,000, they're still kicking, okay? So remember, this isn't a death sentence. This is a sign of how well you're aging. But no, would you rather have be up here or down here? I'll take this one. Thank you, Alex, yeah. and so, but do you see how important this is? This, you know, I'm going to do a few more things on coronary calcium, but do you understand what it is? Do you understand the importance of this? Hopefully you understand a little bit of the politics of it, which is, and by the way, I mean, you know, I did the Congleton show, and who's calling in but Fred Vernocchio, who owns San Luis Diagnostic. Yay! You know, Gary's my hero. Nobody orders more tests than him because I'm good for business, okay? But he knows he doesn't have to pay me or anything. I'm like it for him. I mean, Fred loves me, okay? ain't no question about that. I'm as unpopular as any internist in this area among the cardiologists, okay? But I ain't doing this for popularity. I'm not doing it just to be unpopular. That's just one of the side benefits. just kidding a little. I've got, you know, it really was just a brief story, and I do too many of these, but, you know, I'll stop. But, you know, I was at this health expo over the weekend, and I met with the Pacific Eye people, and they're the ones, you know, age-associated macular degeneration, which basically is another form of aging, basically, when it comes down to it. And now they're finally interested in having somebody who knows nutrition talk to their doctors about what really works for that. 10-15 years ago, they wouldn't, okay? I mean, seriously, I mean, you know, I've been in the county for a long time. And trust me, the flack that I took back then ain't nothing compared to what it is now. And so, because eventually, you know, the truth will set you free. So this stuff is coming out. I've been talking about this stuff forever. And as more studies come out and as more in the cardiologist literature, eventually, finally, at some point, they're going to have to say, oops, you know. But it's very difficult for doctors. I'm not kidding you. Gynecologists still prescribe Premarin and Prevera. They still do it. Okay? Wow. I mean, wow. And when I say wow, if we were science-based, we would not do that. If we were belief-based, we would. Doctors are not supposed to be belief-based. They're supposed to be science-based. That's what you're going to see them for. So, very quite interesting. Okay? And so, so this is not a belief system. Do you understand that? So if anybody says, I don't believe in it, that's fine. It's usually not good to talk to people who don't want to believe in something because they ain't going to listen to you. Okay. So, but this is something you can measure. Is it perfect? I don't know a single perfect test because I already told you. If you have 1,000, it doesn't mean you might not have less problems than the person with 70. But remember what I just told you. I have people who have wicked arthritis who are doing better with a little arthritis. So it's the human nature is pretty complicated, huh? I've seen that all along. So none of this stuff surprises me. Is it easy? No. Okay. But that goes back to, man, what do I do with my cardiac calcium score of 1,000? How I eat, how I exercise, how I approach stress is so individual, and it's a journey you need to take. If I had a calcium score of 1,000, I'd be taking that journey, okay, and saying, wow, man, I have some evidence, some feedback from my coronary arteries that something's not going quite right. Okay, and that's the way to look at it. That's Belvedere. And yeah, Belvedere, there's an old show, The Belvedere, Come Here, Boy, and that's an old cartoon with a dog, but I never had a dog that I could name Belvedere, so So that leads directly into, oh, come on, one of my favorite firesides. Now calm down there, ma'am. Your cat's going to be just fine. Anyways. thank you. All right. Another study, look at this one, Diabetes Care, March 2011. Wow, wait a minute, that's right about now, okay? So, and what this study looked at is in diabetics, so they just broke out and said, we're going to take diabetics. Does coronary calcium score have anything to do with anything? If you come down, basically the look, 70% of their participants died. If you use CAC of 0 to 9, it's the reference group. Most people would tell you 0 is your reference group and then 1 to 10, but I'm not going to complain about that. And so they use that as a reference group, and then they use these other groups. A relative risk of 1.4 means a 40% higher risk of cardiovascular event. Okay, so from a 0 to 9 to 10 to 99, 40% increased risk. 187% increased risk. And you can see the rest. 399, risk went up to 3.04, greater than 1,000, 6.71. Essentially the same thing as on that previous slide, but in diabetics this time, who had a higher overall mortality because this was a, can't remember how many years this study was done over, but it wasn't very long. 7.4, thank you. So again, in diabetics, because the diet faster, you can do quicker studies, and that's why you can get more, you know, and I'm not trying to sound negative, but, and as we talk about, when we look at the epidemiology of what medicines we use and how, why statins are better for men and why they don't work in women and things like that, the large chunk of the mortality comes from women with diabetes and with CRP. It affects them for some reason, I don't know why, for some reason, more so than men. Okay. And if you look at our guy, he's a pretty typical guy with coronary artery disease. He didn't have a high CRP. His fasting insulin, which is a mark of insulin resistance, was low. His A1C is low as well. So he doesn't have those risk factors. He's just got some other ones. Remember, all these things add up together. Okay, men are different than women. Yay. Okay, but being treated all the same, okay, doesn't work. Okay. Let's see. I might. Again, this is what I do. And so coronary artery calcium score improves cardiovascular risk in atherosclerosis, March of 2011. It's interesting because it changes 32.6% of the people. But at the end I said, well, this reclassification, those liberal testing of all these individuals. You know, this is written from a cardiologist, by the way. And so it can upregulate. You can take a coronary calcium score, take normal risk factors, and increase the stratification of risk. Now, be clear, the first patient who came in with an LDL of 309 and small, all these dense LDLs, for the most part, did you really need a cardiac calcium score to prove that he was at high risk? No. But it gives us a place to start with. I have something tangible to work. Can I reverse coronary artery disease? Because it isn't just about reversing the process of the metabolism. Can we literally reverse coronary artery disease? Yes. Dean Ornish just did it with meditation, exercise, and a low-fat diet. That's all. Okay. And so, yes, you can. I ain't saying it's easy, but you can do it. I might go. So this is the key, and this is why this was said. Because if the American Heart Association, and they do, they tell everybody, treat your LDL down to this level, and LDL is all that matters, okay? And despite all the evidence that that's not true, you don't want a test telling you when you need to use more or less of it, because that would be helpful. Okay, can have that.
What's the concept behind the measurement?
The cardiac calcium score? The cardiac calcium score is literally a CAT scan of the coronary arteries, okay, where we're having you hold your breath, you're photographically, the heart is still, and we look at x-rays of the coronary arteries, and I showed you those pictures where there's plaquing on some and not on others, okay? So we're literally looking at how much plaquing there is of the coronary arteries. That's what we're doing. We're determining if you have coronary artery disease or not, which sounds like a pretty good idea if you want to be treated for coronary artery disease. Say that again? Okay, great question. So, and again, I try not to be, I mean, there's so much fun research in this area, but, okay, stable plaques usually aren't the ones. The ones that cause critical stenosis, those aren't usually the one you have a heart attack at. But the more obstructive plaques you have, the more other soft, unstable plaques you have. Those are the ones that rupture and the clot forms, and that's known as a heart attack, okay? So why doesn't everybody present with angina when they walk a certain distance, right? Okay. Because coronary artery disease is a multi-year process, and if you have plaquing going on, you have some unstable plaques, plaques that haven't been kind of held onto your body, made stable, because your body does a good job of this. Remember, people have thousands on the cardiac calcium score. Your body's working with you to stabilize that to make sure it doesn't rupture, okay? But some might, okay? That's why a third of people show up dead, severe heart attack, a third of people show up with a heart attack, third people show up with angina, because you can't wait till obstruction occurs before you look for this. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. And so, and the more of these plaques you have, the greater the chance that you have an unstable plaque. But hear this, this is like any of those odds things, you know. You can have a lot of plaques that are stable, and that's why you don't have a heart attack, or just one really unstable one. Okay, and that's why it's so difficult to just use any score and say, gosh, I wonder if that's going to cause a problem or not. Does that make sense? Okay. Again, we can use this. This is probably more for doctors. I try to set these things up so I can talk to doctors about these things too. But you can take people with cardiomyopathy and use this and say, gosh, I don't need an Agatston score, by the way, is the Dr. Agatston who did South Beach Diet. He's the one who came up with a scoring of cardiac calcium scores. Most of us don't use the term Agatston score anymore. Okay, we just use coronary calcium score or CAC. And basically exclude who might need any intervention whatsoever by just using a coronary calcium, a non-invasive evaluation to determine who's really at risk for coronary events and people who have heart failure for reasons you're not sure why they have it, viruses, other things like that. Really useful test even in some people with disease, not just in an asymptomatic population. Yes. The coronary calcium score. Okay. Coronary calcium score. If you, it's coronary calcium score. And it's, and coronary calcium score can be repeated in a couple of years. Okay. Yeah, repetition is the basis of learning. So coronary calcium scores can be repeated in a couple of years if you have elevations to see, is the intervention I'm doing working? Okay. Am I reversing? And when I say working, let's take the number 54 and a 47-year-old. You would predict by the time he's 50, his score will be about 90, and that will keep him in the 80th percentile. Okay. So if I can do some intervention, lifestyle or otherwise, and he's going to be at 70, we're winning. Okay. Wait a minute, 70, isn't that worse than 54? Well, yes, it's from some perspectives, but no from a standpoint of changing the course of his coronary plaquing. And you can show a lot of evidence when you're slowing down that you are stabilizing the plaques as well. Okay. So does that make sense? So it can be a test you can use and monitor, and especially in asymptomatic people, that's a good one to use. Okay? Laughter is the best medicine. So this is my reminder. Okay? laughter is good medicine, by the way. This whole thing, a lot of stuff is out there about social isolation and cardiovascular risk and a heavy heart. Okay? So there's a lot of stuff on the feeling of being socially isolated, and that depends on the person's perspective, more than a 2.5-fold increased risk of having a cardiac event if you consider yourself socially isolated. And they've shown prospectively that's associated with a larger left ventricular mass, okay, heavy heart, okay, thicker heart, as well as having more coronary artery disease, okay. The idea that you can measure all the risk factors behind this is going to be kind of silly. If you look at some of the studies that look at type A behavior, specifically a subtype called hostility index, okay, that in some studies has been shown to be more predictive of cardiovascular risk than any other test you can measure. And you can't say specifically why being hostile, angry, not lighthearted, okay, can have such a difference. So when you have something like this, and when I talk about laughter as the best medicine, it's sure one of them, okay? So do you have laughter deficiency? Are you socially isolated? My biggest thing is all senses for healing. We are so caught up in our society about using something orally or an IV as the only way to heal, okay? And so you have to think back to those studies in the neonatal intensive care unit, those babies who grew better and got out just with a few strokes, right? Remember hearing about that? You're the same babies. Same organism, just bigger. And a lot more cantankerous attitude to get in the way of you getting better. Okay? So, wow. Do I have a touch deficiency? It's a good question. our society, it's really promoted, okay, or it becomes pathological as a whole industry revolves around, okay. And so, so am I getting enough touch? Okay, am I getting the right smells? And if the right scents take you back to feeling healthy, chocolate chip cookies, popcorn, whatever scent that is, not promoting eating a bunch of chocolate chip cookies, but bake them, give them to the neighbors. That covers a whole lot of ground right there, okay, you know? Okay, so look through the sense of taste. Am I really enjoying my foods? Or if I look, there's beautiful studies of the way the Europeans look at food versus the way Americans look at food. And it's about color, it's this and presentation. Us, it's like, how many grams of fat? You know? And if you're doing that, you're not going to enjoy your food. And it's not going to go into your body well because you're going to win. Okay? And so, and does that make a difference? Heck yes. Okay? So we look at all these senses and you say, where is the issue? Where is the imbalance occurring in my body? Okay? And this is, by the way, how to become your best healer, not through WebMD. Please. They're selling you disease. I checked on the WebMD. Oh, great idea. Okay. yes. How many different diseases you have? You never know when that little twinge in your elbow might mean you're dying. Okay. It's not arthritis. It's a heart attack. I knew it. Thank you, WebMD. Wow. Tune and check into yourself. What does your elbow mean? Don't ask WebMD. Okay. I'm not kidding. But we have lost that. We think that being our best doctor means outsmarting our doctors on WebMD. And trust me, if you can outsmart your doctor on WebMD, you need a new doctor. And so bring up ideas. Your doctors can't think of everything, I understand. But it's more important to go, wow, what does this elbow mean to me? Or my knee, or my whatever, my digestion. And go to all senses for healing. Not just what I can take. Okay, because those deficiencies might be, I have to heal this relationship with my daughter, okay, and I am not going to have a healthy heart until I do. Wow, I've seen that more than once, or my son, or my dad, or my whatever, and that's what you need to look at. Can I give you a double-blind placebo-controlled trial about that? No, okay, which is the horror of Western medicine, which has all you convinced and all the doctors convinced. If there ain't a double-blind placebo-controlled randomized clinical trial proving something, it's quackery. Okay, that's how we belittle everything, right? Quackery. Double-blind trial? No, quackery. The heck with your daughter. There's no double-blind trials about that. More or less what we're saying, right? Does it make sense to any one of us? Not really, if you really sit down and think about it. Okay. Anybody telling you how to eat? How sad do you think you even need somebody to tell you how to eat? Get some few basic pieces of information, and then tell yourself how to eat. What kind of exercise you do depends on what you like to do. And then, well, I don't like any exercise. I'm ready for that one. keep trying. Finding things, you'll find the long-term health benefits of them. But not everybody. It's like when I teach stress reduction. Not everybody can do just mantra-based meditation. But there's a whole world of techniques out there that deal with self-realization and stress reduction, which is essentially the essence of being human, a really important thing. And so... But is laughter good medicine? Sure. So if you, I have people with laughter deficiency. They have Led Zeppelin deficiency too. Okay, so, you know, when was the last time you liked Led Zeppelin? When did you last listen to Led Zeppelin? Well, put them on, man. They rock. Okay. Do you feel better when you listen to Led Zeppelin? Well, there you go. When you feel better, you're making endorphins. You're making all kinds of wonderful things for your body that can heal you. Led Zeppelin, or Beethoven, or Garth Brooks, or whatever. You know. So. And this goes into this whole thing, effective healthy lifestyle behaviors on the association between leukocyte telomere length and coronary artery calcium. I know you guys read all this stuff too. However, what this goes into, we want longer telomeres. We will live longer, okay? There's a direct association, a man is as old as his blood vessels, between coronary artery calcium, high levels, and shorter telomeres. Why is that? You're aging faster. Remember what I said? It's just aging your coronary arteries. Of course, you can modify the effects of these things by eating right. Whoa! How about that? Yes. Can you eat more fruits and vegetables have a direct effect on the length of your telomeres? Yes. Telomeres, once again, are the little caps on the end of your DNA, and as we continue to replicate, they get a little shorter with each time until, you know, they can't replicate anymore and time's up. Okay. But again, even though we like to take this to the level of genetics, and I love genetics, but I'm not going to bore you with that stuff, is that you can change these things. Our food, our direct biological response modifiers, that means the food that you eat goes to your genes and talks to them. Okay? That makes it really interesting if you think about it. It's not just what you eat that is important, but the food, the way it's prepared, the energetics around it, is going and talking to your DNA. okay? I'd make really good decisions, okay? Because they literally turn on and off our genes, our foods, biological response modifiers, not just about building healthy cells, which it does that too, okay? And it can make a big difference between telomere length, how long we live, and coronary calcium score. It's the same thing. And, of course, healthy lifestyle makes a difference. Independent. So important for you to hear this. Okay. Wait a minute. I still have a high coronary calcium score even while I ate these veggies. It's modifying the effect of that coronary calcium score, and you can't see it sometimes. So sometimes we get so caught up in the numbers, we miss the reality. Losing the forest for the trees. Heard that before? Okay. So there's all kinds of studies showing your blood pressure is 180 and you're really fit, okay, versus 180 and really not. The difference in stroke risk at those blood pressures is about 400% difference. The biggest thing you can do is become really fit, and if it doesn't affect your blood pressure one iota, it rocks. But what are you going to do? I exercise. My blood pressure is still 180. Wham! And stop exercising, not realizing how wonderful it was for you, because we get so caught up on the numbers, we don't see. Because we just don't know how important that part is. We just think all we have to do is use medicines. I'm not saying run around with a blood pressure of 180 is a good thing. I'm just saying it would be much more important for you to become very fit than it would be to lower your blood pressure if all you're interested in is just cardiovascular risk, which would be difficult not to see why you wouldn't be. All this is fun stuff. Yeah, I won't go into the receptor activator of nuclear factor kappa beta ligand and osteoprotuberin. But what we're going to find in the future is what the only reason this is up here about wrinkle and OPG signaling is what we need as doctors is better markers. Remember about the old lines on the telephone, on the transmitters, portable radios, whatever they were, and things like that. We want to find what else is out there helping us determine about who's at risk. And we're getting fun little things like this to show that we can measure certain inflammatory markers and others about who has that cardiac calcium score and might be just relatively fine versus really needs more intervention. And we need more and more of these things to help us determine our risk. There's a great push against measuring things like this, even though there's lots of trials showing that they're useful, because if you're just going to give drugs anyways, why would you ever measure these things? The reason is the reason you treat these things is with using herbs like curcumin and boswellia and other things are really great at treating these things. There's not a single drug company out there interested in you knowing about these things. That's it. I always love this one. So before I screw up, and we have about 20 minutes left in our talk, and I have more slides on other cardiovascular risk factors, like I kind of led you early on. So we started off with a gentleman, and he has, you know, basically healthy, pretty wicked high cholesterol, familial hyperlipidemia, okay, high homocysteine, remember those things, then the wrong forms of LDLs, et cetera. 80th percentile in coronary artery disease, but we're not going to scare him or anything else like that. I'm going to say, listen, I would be on a statin if I were you. And he's going to go, what? Okay, because I would be. Okay, now, hold on. Let me clarify what I'm going to say. Because there are wonderful, there's all kinds of data in guys with coronary artery disease. He is a guy with coronary artery disease and the prevention of heart attack. For me not to offer therapy like that when he has such high numbers would be wrong. Now, remember what I said earlier about whether you do well with meat, whether you do well with certain forms of exercise. Listen to yourself. We'll try a different statin, and we'll see if he does well on it. Okay? Does it make better? I can give you reasons why if we treat well enough as coronary arteries, things, and this is always what sells to guys, if we get those erections better, he'll be behind it. Okay? So, you know, so anything that improves a guy's erection is going to work. Okay? So we're going to work on that side of things, and if he's getting erections, even if he has a bunch of other side effects, he'll be happy. It's true. So got to work with whatever works here, folks. Okay? But we don't want to have him be sick. So some people tolerate statins, some don't. He wasn't given CoQ10 along with a statin, and it's been well documented since the inception of that medicine that you have to be, because certain people are going to be sensitive to it and others aren't. Take CoQ10, okay, and it can dramatically change the effect of that statin on that person. So we'll do what we can to modify, because this is integrative medicine, by the way. It's not to say, gosh, yes, there is a proven medical therapy for this man, including a medicine. I'll put them on that medicine and do everything I can to modify the side effects of that medicine as best as we know, knowing I don't know diddly, okay? I'm sure of that, okay? But do the best I can with my lack of knowledge, okay? Because that's all we can do, all right? And see how he does with that medicine. And I think that has a lot to do because he's part of a culture that told him, oh, those medicines are bad for you. And they're not always bad for you. So I'm going to put him on a statin medicine. Okay. He is going to be on aspirin as well. Why? Because he has hypercoagulability. Remember that? He's going to be on aggressive approach to lower homocysteine. Okay. And when I say that, you've got to hear this. Okay. This is one of those areas where you have to be knowledgeable about. There's as many trials showing that if you just take folic acid or just take B12, okay, to lower homocysteine, you will cause heart attacks. Okay? Once again, we've gone past the idea that vitamins are just useless or just give you expensive urine. There are many trials showing that they will cause heart attacks. And I go, whoa, or cause cancer in some cases. Back to what we said earlier about calcium. If you want basic nutritional truths, okay, if anybody tells you to take one supplement and far excess of its family members, it will be wrong. Okay, I'm talking about for a general population. I'm not talking about any one individual treating one thing. I'm talking about general advice now. So, and I promise this is relevant. Why does high calcium cause such a degree of vasospasm, stroke, and heart? It's extraordinarily predictable, and it's, all the mechanisms have been shown. The most common mineral depletion actually is magnesium, high-stress society, processed foods. You take high levels of calcium, you compete for magnesium absorption, you deplete magnesium further and lead to higher blood pressure, more vasospasm. Huh. So what moron ever came up with the idea of taking calcium? Your doctor. But why did you talk to a doctor about nutrition? They don't know anything about it. Ah, really? Talk to a nutritionist. No nutritionist has ever recommended taking calcium supplements like that because they understand nutrition. Okay, at least I hope not. So on that order, B vitamins are a symphony. Okay, so where do we get here from here? I just want to make sure. Minerals, a symphony. Okay, B vitamins, a symphony. Okay. Most of the studies combining at least B6, folic acid, B12, probably some trimethylglycine, which is another methylator. Okay, it's how we lower homocysteine. I know it's too complex, but unfortunately it is too complex, and unfortunately you don't know how to do it. Okay, and I gotta be clear about this. If you think you can choose supplements and just take B12 or just take something else, you might hurt yourself. Okay, that's part of the reason I said earlier I don't think supplements might not even should be on the market. Okay, because there's enough danger in doing it the wrong way. Because even just lowering the homocysteine isn't enough. Because in these studies, and diabetics especially, and I can't emphasize this enough, a diabetic with high homocysteine, they're at high risk. You can lower homocysteine and dramatically worsen kidney function, cardiovascular risk, okay, with those B vitamins. You mean B vitamins can do that? Yeah. Okay, really profound things, these little vitamin things of ours, okay? And so once again, we'll lower homocysteine with a balanced amount of B vitamins, a multi of specific B vitamin combination that I use in combination to treat his homocysteine. We'll see what numbers he gets, okay? So you understand how many things we're going to have to treat, and I'm going to have to really talk with him. What are these other factors that are past lab testing? Remember, that's just as important. So we'll treat homocysteine. He'll go on a statin if he does, and I'll try him on at least two other statins before I give up on them. Okay, because they're unique medicines that have sometimes different. But if he doesn't tolerate them, we won't make it the end of the world. We'll go off. We'll try red yeast rice. There was a study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, good old Western Medical Journal, okay, a couple years ago, showing in this trial 100% of the people who didn't tolerate statins tolerated red yeast rice. Now, the beauty of that study is they actually had placebo control, so nobody knew they were actually getting red-yeast rice. There's such a placebo effect to taking medicines that my experience isn't the same. I have a lot of people who don't tolerate red-yeast rice, and I say a lot. I'd say probably of my statin intolerant patients, 70% are fine on a red-yeast rice. Red-yeast rice is an herbal supplement that has a statin component. Many good Chinese trials showing that they actually have the same benefits in terms of decreasing cardiovascular risk, especially in men. I didn't quote the study from JAMA. JAMA study 3 years ago, statins in women are a completely unproven therapy. Heart disease in women is different than heart disease in men. Okay? And so I'm not saying never to use them, but I have more cases of failures with Lipitors and statins in women than I do in men. And I've seen that again and again and again. I mean failures. people who have rapid restenosis, other things, and they've never been on a statin. They go on a statin, and they do vastly worse. And those are much more common to be women than men. These, the fact that the idea that these drugs are miracles, the answer to human, you know, suffering, just not true. They statistically decrease your risk of a recurrent cardiovascular event. That is true. Okay, and so. So anyways, we'll put him on a statin, we'll treat his homocysteine, we'll deal with the hypercoagulability. Of course, we'll do a lot of the basic nutritional things. This guy's also very interested. Remember I said he was interested in that supplement thing, and he was taking this list of things. And let me just cover a few things that were brought up even while I was out there. Chelation. How many people have heard of chelation? Show me. So most of you. Okay. Chelation means clawing onto, is a valid therapy for the treatment of heavy metal toxicity. It is as Western medical as it gets. Okay. Let me spend some time with this. I'll just do a couple of minutes. Okay. And so the rest of the slides, although fun, okay, and go into other cardiovascular risk, are really, we might as well focus on some other things. Basically, World War II, painting naval warships, okay, a lot of old-timers were doing it too. They didn't have masks. This is, again, part of unions and everything else, and things like that. And basically, heavy metal, lead toxicity rampant, okay? They started chelating them, Western medical therapy, to get the lead out of their system, and a few of the old-timers with angina were getting better, okay? And basically, from that point on, a whole industry was spawned called chelation therapy for cardiovascular disease. No good trials, no nada, and really, every good Western trial on chelation therapy shows it doesn't work. My personal experience with people doing chelation therapy all over shows dramatically worse cardiac calcium scores, progression towards heart disease, towards needing bypass and surgery. Now, chelation, C-H-E-L-A-T-I-O-N, chelation therapy. C-H-E-L, chelation literally is a Latin word meaning to claw onto. What you do is give EDTA, a form of chemical that goes into the body, gloms onto the lead so that your body can excrete it. It's difficult for your body to excrete it without a little assistance. Okay? So, in current trials, if you really want to look at the fun stuff, if you look at people who happen to have coronary artery disease and heavy metal toxicity, it's a good therapy. And guess what? That's where the original stuff came from, okay? So is there a reason to screen for heavy metal toxicity in everybody? It is difficult to see who might be exposed and not, based upon their history of exposures, et cetera, sandblasting, et cetera. But it is sometimes worth looking for that. And if you have, this is really important to hear, Western doctors, don't do chelation. It's bogus, BS, whatever. And by the way, let's do one of the things. The idea, the EDTA, the sluice thing we goes into your arteries and gloms onto calcium and gets out is absolutely biochemically untrue, cannot occur. So when you see on these naturopathic websites about it doing that, that's simply wrong, misleading, and true quackery, if you want to use that term. Okay, I'm not a big fan of that one. Okay, but it's what leads us down the pathway of saying, wow, do all these natural therapies stink? No, just when people sell things that way. And again, Julian Whitaker. So why can't you trust everything Julian Whitaker does? Because, no, he has a money-making clinic based on giving IV chelation to just about everybody, telling them that it does things that it cannot do. There's an enormous placebo response to getting IV chelation, though. Okay. So when you look at the placebo-controlled trials, the placebo group does every bit as well as the the chelation group. But since 60 to 80% of people feel better, of course that means 60 to 80% of people get chelation, feel better just because they got something. The human being loves to be healed, okay? So, is it dangerous? Well, I have found everything that can help can hurt too. So, I don't recommend chelation therapy. And my experience, I already told you, with people going to local chelation therapists has been much worse coronary artery disease in my patients. Back in the days when I said, well, most of the data doesn't indicate it hurts, so if you want to do that, I'm not discouraging you, okay? I've done that before, okay? I'm not encouraging people to do it anymore for these very reasons, unless we look for heavy metal toxicity and we treat that. Heavy metals go to fatty tissues, so it makes sense that lead would be higher concentration or mercury and could cause an inflammatory effect and an unstable plaque. It makes actually pretty good sense how chelation therapy would be good for doing what it does do, get rid of heavy metals, and might be exacerbating people who have heavy metals and coronary artery disease. Does that make sense? Okay. But by the way, if somebody doesn't do well with IV chelation, we certainly don't recommend oral or rectal or the other forms as well. There's a question?
My question, we have toxicity in our foods today.
Mm-hmm. If, again, the question goes into toxicity in general. There's so many forms of toxins that can go into why we might having more Alzheimer's, more coronary artery disease, and it goes on and on past fish and mercury, etc. I do think it's worthwhile. The only thing that chelation therapy can do is remove heavy metals if they have the toxins. So I would tell people, if you think that you might have heavy metal toxicity, get tested for it and treat it if it's there. And if it's there, you can do, especially the EDTA suppositories are somewhat worthwhile. As the oral chelation, for the most part, not useful. Okay, yeah, suppositories useful to some degree. But again, to some degree, at removing heavy metals from the system, we don't have trials showing that they prevent any form of cardiovascular event, okay? But, again, I can see how it might be, and I think in that population, remember how about risk stratification? Not aspirin for everybody, aspirin for hypercoagulable. Not EDTA for nobody or for everybody. Try to identify the people that might benefit from it, okay? And that's where, and that's why, again, when you... Why would middle path medicine never sell in this world? Because it's actually relying upon the very fact, the nature of medicine is there are no truths like that. There's no absolutes. Okay. So the only thing, you can go on TV and say, I have the answer to all women's hormones. You have to be telling an untruth. The only thing that sells in our society actually is the things that aren't true. Mm-hmm. Kind of the way it is.
If you're using red yeast rice, do you still need the CoQ10?
The question is, if you're taking red yeast rice, the herbal extract that's used with a statin component to help lower LDL and give you whatever benefits statins do. The last talk I went on and on about this, that statins work independent of lowering LDL. It's something else that's working. Okay, that's why it's one of the things that I do use in people if I can all do it. If you're taking that, should you take CoQ10 as well? Yes. Okay. The question now is about niacin, and as you know, there's many forms of niacin, niacin has actually a bunch of little neat effects outside of just lowering triglycerides and raising HDL, and as you might know, if you look at the side effect profile of niacin, it can affect your liver, it can cause ulcers, I mean, it can do a lot of stuff in your body, okay? So when we give niacin at the dosage of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 milligrams a day, ain't a vitamin anymore. That's the first thing I want to make it very clear to you. Oh, I like those natural therapies. 2,000 of niacin is a drug. Don't be fooling yourself, okay? It's just a drug, okay? Oh, but it's a vitamin. I can get it in my health food store. No, it's a drug. I've seen more toxicity with niacin than I've seen with Lipitor by far, okay? So, now, I'm not saying not to try it or consider it. If you have low HDL, high triglycerides, and yes, if you have, for men and for women with coronary artery disease, there are some trials that support the prospective use of niacin at that dosage, but here's the kicker. The best form is the immediate-release niacin, okay, and that's the one that gives you the flush. If I take even 50 milligrams of niacin, it's like I get red ears and, you know, like that. I had a patient the other day, he says he likes that, and I go, okay. Sure, dude. He likes his niacin. I'm not kidding. No, I get a rush. To, you know, I take it 3 times a day. I am not kidding you because he likes that rush. Okay, that's somebody who's convinced himself of something. But I'm not gonna. But it's helped his cholesterol profile, and it's a good thing. So, and he's got no signs of toxicity, so he's on niacin. Okay, more often than not, and I use this one form of slow release. I know, but answering questions is more important than the rest of the slides. I used to use a slow form release form of niacin called inositol hexanicotinate. Don't remember that. It isn't nearly as useful as some of the other slow release niacins, including one medicine called Niaspan. Okay, Niaspan is a good medicine. You have to monitor. When I say good medicine, it gets what you want. You have to monitor liver functions and other things while you're on it. Okay, you can take it at night. You can actually take your aspirin, like it was something a little bit at night that minimizes the flush if you're taking aspirin, and that minimizes the flush, and you sleep through most of your flushing. Okay, and so. And it's really expensive if you don't have insurance or insurance doesn't cover it. So the over-the-counter, like health food store niacins like we have, are less expensive if you're paying for it and your insurance isn't covering it. But if the insurance covers it, then the niaspan is less expensive. It's kind of this, one of the few supplements. But remember, it's a drug. It ain't a supplement, okay? I know low-dose, you know, niacin is a vitamin. I, of course, understand that. But, you know, maybe, like I said, even 50 milligrams for me is enough to give me a flush. So, you know, I know it's having pharmacological effects. So niacin is a reasonable thing. And one more thing. Fish oils, that's part of my basic nutritional protocol. If you want something that's been proven to probably positively affect almost anything you can do, EPA and DHA, the good omega-3s, are the best things out there for all health. Okay, and so the let me emphasize, flax oil doesn't do it, krill oil doesn't do it, it's EPA and DHA, okay? Now, when I say that, that has these studies proving these benefits. I'm not saying krill oil is bad for you. I'm just saying krill oil has never been shown to remotely as good. I'm just bringing that up because so many people are hearing krill oil, krill oil, krill oil. It's just one of those supplements that comes back and forth, cycles back and forth. I've never seen any really positive effects to it. It doesn't affect cholesterol profiles and absolutely unequivocally, without question, does not replace EPA, DHA. That's a marketing ploy meant to make money out of you. Okay? If you take Neptune krill oil, sorry, that's one of the bigger brands, and you say, gosh, I feel better, rock on. I don't think it's dangerous. Okay. How do we get away with selling Coke on TV? How do we get away with I can tell you just about anything. You know, it's like I said, the things that sell in today's world, if you just look at it and just kind of see it for what it is, it's like, wow, yeah, lies are the things that sell. Okay, I get it. Disease sells. Okay, I get it. Okay. Making money sells. Okay, so I'm not going to tell you that Coke doesn't kill more people than Neptune krill oil, because Coke does, okay? But they got a bigger advertising campaign than krill oil. So, again, it just goes out there. I don't think Coke, you know, they're breeding a new generation or whatever they're doing. I don't think they really think people drink Coke and they feel better. I don't think so, anyways. For you first, yeah.
No flush.
Yeah. Yeah, the no-flush niacin, inositol-hexanicotinate. My experience, hopefully what I tell you, is measure your tests. It works in about 30 to 40% of people in terms of getting a good reduction, okay? Regular niacin works in 80 to 90% of the people, okay? So I've kind of made a transition over the years saying, listen, it's too low a percent hit on that one, and I'm transitioning people to other forms of niacin just because it's not as effective. Okay, so most, if you look at a no-flush niacin, it's usually this thing called inositol hexanicotinate. I'm sorry, I didn't name it. It's what it is. And so, and it's not as effective. So I'm probably moving away towards using other forms of niacin. Yes? The plant. I didn't plant this man, by the way. I have thrown away more fish oils than my people that I have vitamin E supplements. And so, okay. Right. So first thing I tell people is that, you know, the fish oils, EPA and DHA, and I'm going to get to that question, okay? And look, there's cod liver oil, Carlson cod liver oil, good cod liver oil. So, and cod liver oil, a swig a day is a good thing to use, okay, like Miranda's holding up back there. But this is one of those things where I could go on and on about the triglyceride form versus the ethyl ester form. You can go into a whole bunch of things in the processing. When I did the lipid study, I did a series of slides on this one guy. He went to Costco, bought his fish oils, and his triglycerides went up hundreds of points and all these other things. Most people are out there buying rancid fat pellets of death. Okay? And if they're less expensive, and that's your most important thing, go for it, okay? So that's my experience of people buying fish oils. They'll buy the least expensive thing, and they're buying not only just crap, but it's worse than crap, okay? Rancid fat, okay? I dare you to plug away into some of those things. I've done it too many times. They are horrific, okay? I mean, seriously, if you go to Costco and bought the fish, and unfortunately you left it in the refrigerator too long, would you still eat it just because you bought it? Okay, well, that's the way people are with this stuff. You have to get good quality fish oil. And by the way, online, two things I would never, ever buy are fish oils and probiotics. You don't know where they've been stored, and they probably don't have live organisms, and they're probably rancid, and you just don't know. They might not be, but that's the hit or miss part of it. They might be good one month and not so good the next month, okay? You can't rely on quality control when it comes to most of the online herbal things for fish oils and probiotics. So on the basic nutritional protocol, I have a list of good vendors that have pharmaceutical-grade fish oils, okay? And among them include Arctic Pure, there's Orthomolecular is a good company, Pure Encapsulations, Metagenics. There are many good companies, not just one or two, like Barry Sears on his omega-3 said, like, there's only two good fish oils, and one of them is mine. Barry has some good fish oils, but it's not only him that can make pharmaceutical-grade fish oils. And so they are expensive, I'm going to be clear, but to process them the way they need to in a nitrogen-free environment, et cetera, to keep them from becoming peroxidized, it's difficult. Once you have opened up a bottle by small amounts, people who complain in my store, why don't you get the bigger bottle? Because it's not good for you. You want a dark bottle. You want to keep it in the refrigerator or the freezer. You can keep it at room temperature if you garf them. Okay, and so take a lot, sorry. and so, but you really do need to get quality fish oil supplements, and really, and I can't emphasize this enough, if cost is your primary thing, buy nothing. Saves you the most money, okay? If that isn't the primary thing, find a good couple of things. Again, I do worry about these Carlson fish oils, and I've seen the same thing that are sold online for things under wholesale price, and I've seen bad results from those, so I know it's so tough to say it's just the vendor, but where you get it as well, okay? So, no, not all fish oils are the same. And just one other brief aside, don't let anybody tell you to just concentrate it to only EPA or only DHA. Okay, there was a while back, 5-10 years ago, where EPA was the fish oil to take. And then they realized, wow, that didn't do so good. Now it's this whole thing swung the other way. DHA is the only one that matters. You'll see that. That's not true either. The fish oils. Depends on the food source. Okay, most fish sources, it's about 300 of EPA to 200 of DHA. Sources like calamari are just the opposite, 200 of EPA to 300 of DHA. But they're in that 50-50 range. Okay, I know that's like 60-40, but in that range. You want a balanced fish oil. If you get the triglyceride form, there's at least a 15 to 20% increase in absorption. Okay, so that the triglyceride form is better from that standpoint. Okay. They'll say triglyceride form, okay? But get quality fish oils, or please, 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 don't buy anything, okay? Capsules versus liquids is a question. I mean, again, my personal experience, guys, I'll swig a thing of cod liver oil and put it away. It's tough to get women to do that, and they make that face right there. The very face that she just made is exactly why I don't recommend that to most women, because they're going to do that to me. And if I'm feeling like doing it, I just do it for the face. and then I go, I didn't think you'd like that. How about the capsules? So you want a dosage of EPA and DHA, the two combined. You look at the capsule. Now, it's really important to hear this. Let's say a standard fish oil capsule at 7 o'clock, I'm sorry, it's 1,000 milligrams of fish oil, but it'll probably have 500 of EPA and DHA. And that's the number I'm talking about, okay? The dosage for cardiovascular benefits is around 2,500 milligrams. So, and that would mean of that 1,000-milligram fish oil that has 500 of EPA and DHA, you would be taking 5 a day, okay? And you can do the math from there because, and that's the only thing that bothers me with Nordic Naturals, which has a good company, but you'll see sometimes it's two soft gels, and the two soft gels have 300 milligrams of EPA and DHA, and you can do the math. That means 16 a day. Yes, it does. If you want to do that, so be it. It's easier to get the dose by a swig a day of cod liver oil or fish oil of your choice. That's what I do. When you travel, yes, I've had people really mad about. I was like, we went traveling and our cod liver oil broke in our suitcase. I'm so mad at you. and so, yes, I try to make a point of traveling with the capsules and things because, man, she was not happy with me. Cod liver oil everywhere and had to buy everything new. And what was I going to do about it? No, I wasn't going to do anything about it. Sorry, but, you know. So traveling is better with that, with the capsules, absolutely. So fish oil is very, very important. I'm actually going to stop at this slide. There's some other things in terms of, but just one other basic, I talked about this on the radio show. Blood sugar, blood sugar, blood sugar. Okay. Now, especially for women, okay, there's studies showing that the hemoglobin A1C, okay. Now, let me see where I'm at my slides. I'm going to lie to you. Okay. Hemoglobin A1C, the combined effects of hemoglobin A1C, C-reactive protein, on the progression of subclinical carotid atherosclerosis. Now, once again, the carotid is their artery here, okay? And like I said, it's some people are using carotid scans for looking for screening for atherosclerosis. I'm just going to tell you, there's much more data on coronary calcium scoring, so that's why I use that as a screening. If people want to use carotid scans, it's okay, but the data is still in a lot of flux right now, so it, obviously there's studies going on. I'm not saying different, but I'm saying if I was screening for atherosclerosis, I'd use the coronary calcium score, okay? So, but what this showed, and this is something I want you to see, okay, as this is looking at the risk, looking at the hemoglobin A1C. Now, let's talk about this for a second. Hemoglobin A1C, and by the way, it's after 7, and I know I do this, so I apologize to you. If anybody needs to leave, you know, I understand. I jump out, and I won't take any offense. Okay. So, is how much, it's glycosylation, how much sugar is glommed onto your hemoglobin? And it's measured in a percentage. Okay. Notice it's in a percentage. Okay. So literally, the lifespan of the red cells, 60 to 90 days, it's a 3-month average of your blood sugar based upon how much sugar gloms onto your hemoglobin at the time they're born, okay, so to speak. Okay. So we can get a good measure of your average blood sugars and try to bypass when somebody just goes in really stressed for fasting blood sugar. It might be high just because they're stressed that day. It's not as reliable. This is a really reliable test. Now, really, really important things for you to hear. Okay. Under 5 is optimal. When I say under 5 is optimal, that's not based upon any trials using drugs and things, because there are some trials when people are using certain medicines and things. If you treat someone's A1C under 5, you're actually increase their risk of heart attacks and things. So a natural, non-drugged A1C of 5 and under is optimal, okay, based upon, and that would be equivalent of a baseline fasting blood sugar of about 70. Okay, and that's healthy, especially found in athletes. I find it very rare these days, except for my athletes, that an A1C is 5 or less. Okay, so, and they use different numbers, and you can see there are very small variations in here. By the time you get to a fasting blood sugar of 70 to 105, which is in the reference range of your lab, okay, all right, very important to hear this. These are all within the normal range in your lab. Okay, you can see an A1C of 5 to 6. Okay, that's why there's about a 35-point difference in blood sugar between a 5 and a 6 on the A1C, which correlates with a 70 to 105 fasting blood sugar fairly equivalently. Notice what a big difference this makes between an A1C of less than 5.3, not even remotely with most people, most of my patients, if I'm lucky to get them in this area, okay, but as we start to get towards insulin resistance and glucose intolerance, because 5.7 isn't diabetic, it's not till over 6, okay, we see this relative list, odds ratio is like a relative risk, okay, and they use basically less than 5.3. Notice how the relative risk or odds ratio is 1. That's what they're comparing to, okay. And as you just go to 5.4 to 5.6, notice that the overall, you get 2.5-fold increased risk of cardiac disease and that minor blood sugar change. Please knock that home. But more importantly, what you need to see is that relative risk in men is only 1.4, and women it's 4.7. Okay? Women are different than men. Okay? And I can't emphasize this enough. The epidemiology is really focused a lot on guys, especially the Framingham data, okay, and things like that. And it applies some to women. But the real risk factors for women are A1C and CRP. It's a risk factor for guys, too. I'm not saying to blow it off, but you notice how as it gets higher, it doesn't make as big a difference. And something about this level in here, the odds ratio at this number seems to be worse than here. That's why they're saying that we need to do this over a greater length of time and see how much this data pans out. Use different numbers, because this is a very odd result. Why is an A1C in this middle range worse than higher? I do want you to see that, by the way, okay? And that's why this is a really this is a data that's just very recent. But I just kind of pulled it off as a great example, because you don't see many studies breaking women away from men. That's why I have trouble finding these kinds of studies to show to you, okay? And I don't want you to lock this into things. But you need to hear this. If you're interested in cardiovascular risk, especially if you're women, okay, you need to know what your CRP is and your A1C, okay? And you need your A1C as low as practical, not through drugs. For heaven's sakes, I'm not talking about that. Through lifestyle intervention, okay? And again, There's nutritional supplements. I have things back there for that, but I think you picked up on this. I'm really not focusing on supplements much today. I'm talking about lifestyle, 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 finding out what things you're at risk for, and then get together with a doctor who's savvy about all these things, okay, and then come up with a plan for you as a person, okay, because, you know, all I can do is talk to the general population. I can't sit there and say, just like I'm going to do with this guy, and say, okay, this is the things for you. Well, what about my blood sugar? Well, you know, his blood sugar is not an issue, so we're not going to deal with it. I'm going to tell him to eat right, you know. But you need to understand, we've got to focus on what's pertinent for him, okay? And if his numbers didn't support being on a statin, trust me, I'd be the first person to telling him not to be on a statin. I've done that, too. And so anyways, but in terms of looking at your cardiovascular risk, there is a difference between men and women. This whole thing about pushing statins on women is really an unvalidated it's just not valid. Let's just leave it at that, okay? I can tell you why it's occurring, but it's not because of its woman's health, okay? And I'm not saying women blow off your cholesterol profile. I'm not saying guys blow off your blood sugar, okay? I'm just saying, for some reason there's this unique thing. Let me, do you mind me doing just another slide or two? Okay, I'll really try to focus. This is one of my favorite slides, sorry. Taking things too literally. Okay, cool. Yes, and please, anybody who wants to go, I completely understand. So on this, now this is a neat International Journal of Obesity, again, March of this year. Okay, so I've been trying to keep you up to some really current fun stuff, okay. What they're finding, especially in women, again, I'm just going to, these findings suggest, especially in women, persistent chlamydia pneumonia infection may be associated with overweight obesity independently of more traditional risk factors. And this is International Journal of Obesity, Advanced Online Publication is what that's saying. If you remember a while back, there was an infectious disease theory of coronary artery disease, and they were looking at chlamydia pneumonia, okay? And it didn't really pan out because chlamydia pneumonia, which is a type of infection, okay, might. Now, I don't want you all going running to your doctor. Dr. Borsman said chlamydia pneumonia is the reason why I'm fat, okay? I know you wouldn't do that, but but it's really interesting. The CRP test, especially in women, is associated with some low-grade infections. And for some reason, that seems to be a bigger issue in women's obesity than men's obesity. And one of the things why unexplained weight gain, is occurring. And elevated, both alone and jointly, with elevated hsCRP, an upper quartile was found to be significantly associated with elevated body mass index in the whole study population. Okay? And so what we find as we do some studies, okay, in young women, okay, in young birth cohort, and follow them over time, okay, is what is it that's causing obesity, which is leading to the CRP, which is leading to these other things, which leads to the coronary artery disease? And it's really quite interesting. We don't know, okay? And this is where I'm going to point out to you. Often people I see are frustrated with the doctor. The standard lab tests haven't shown what's going on. And I'm not telling you it's all about the lab tests, but it's interesting to really come back again, because this is obviously just recent, where we're circling back again. We know that it's not as simple as calories in and calories out as being the reason for central obesity in so many men and women. Again, women seem to be more at risk for this one than men. So it is quite interesting that CRP is a marker of inflammation, but we don't know what's inflamed. Okay, and unfortunately, it's a feed-forward cycle. The heavier we are, the higher the CRP. You know, with the chicken or the egg phenomenon, right? Because adipose tissue is metabolically active and leads to inflammation in the body. So is the elevated CRP causing the obesity? The obesity because the elevated CRP? At the time we see the person, we don't know. And I'm not telling people chlamydia pneumonia is sort of like krill oil. Okay? People want to study it every decade. Oh my gosh, is chlamydia pneumonia causing coronary artery disease? Oops, it doesn't cause coronary artery disease. You know, it's caused coronary artery disease. You know, like, we know that there's some link between chronic infections and obesity. Okay, that's all I'm going to tell you, the elevation of CRP. And so if you're frustrated and losing weight, of course we got to eat right. Of course we got to do things. You got to look and say, wow, there might be some metabolic factors I can't see. So, again, knowing that can sometimes be a lot less frustrating because the frustration for weight loss, especially among women, is so rampant. And I absolutely, unequivocally know, including things like heavy metal toxicity, can be reasons for having extra adiposity of fat tissue. And Stu, I love this. Is, I was supposed to ad lib on this one about, you know, spiders being afraid of snakes being afraid of spiders, but anyways. But I won't do that to you. One other quickie. This is actually the last slide. Soy phytoestrogens. Because we're already at the end. I can't do all my fun far slide stuff. I know. Okay. She's supposed to, like, you know, keep me from doing exactly what I'm doing right now. And we always get to that point where she knows that I'm not listening, and I'm going to be paying for it later on. And so, however, looking at high soy phytoestrogens in this trial, once again, Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism, nothing, no bizarre journal we're talking about here. Soy phytoestrogen supplementation on thyroid function. Now, here's that kind of catch-22 of medicine, okay? I'm going to summarize this trial for you, okay, which basically showed that higher levels of soy phytoestrogens did lead to a higher rate of clinical hypothyroidism. And I want to be clear, I was told in the past, and I've told people this, that the amount of soy you have to eat was higher than could affect thyroid function, because that's what I've been taught, okay, even though we heard that there was this association. This is a level of 60 milligrams of phytoestrogens is not that high, okay. And it did lead to increase in amount of overt hypothyroidism. So, yes, soy can affect thyroid function. Now, you need to hear this, though, okay? The women on the soy had significant reduced insulin resistance, CRP, and blood pressure. See how it's kind of a darned if you do and darned if you don't, okay? So, meaning any metabolic parameter that you want to look at, soy was really good, okay? The nice thing about this, this was in white women, okay, and why do I bring that up? Most of the studies on Caucasians aren't nearly as good as in Asians, okay? So really good effects of soy food supplementation on women, okay, as far as that goes, in terms of cardiac things, but you have to monitor thyroid things, okay? And I said, what are you supposed to do with a piece of information like that? Well, maybe I can check myself, see how I do with soy. Because you hear people out there, soy's bad for you, soy's good for you. And guess what the truth is? Soy is good for some people and it's bad for some people. That's exactly what this study shows. And you wouldn't want to jump on this and say, because you'll, I guarantee you can get people on this thing, I told you soy was bad for you, screws your thyroid up, man. Okay? Because they don't want to look at this. And other people go, I told you soy was good for you, helps cardiac with stuff and all these other things, and forget about the thyroid part of things. Truth's always in the middle, right? Okay? So you can look at this and say, how do I do with it? And test appropriately, and I am done. Any last questions? Oh, wait, last questions. To the drawing. Okay, one more question.
The niacin is taken out of the family of B vitamins, isn't it? If you just use niacin, you should keep it in the family.
Oh, the question is, and a good question, if you ever took something like niacin at a high dosage, you'd want to be on a complex B vitamin supplement as well to make sure you don't develop an imbalance in other Bs. And that's why I don't mind taking extra B12 as long as you're on the rest of the B vitamins, extra folic acid, etc. Okay, so, yes. All right, going to do a drawing. I'm going to shut up.